Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
Today, a special broadcast. We play back for you the second in our summer virtual event series, The Exchange Live from Home, which examines the impact of COVID-19 on New Hampshire. The event was recorded Tuesday night, and we focused on the personal finance aspects of the pandemic. Just a reminder, we won't take any new comments from you, our listeners. We hope you enjoy the show. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange Live from Home. And for the next hour, we're going to focus on personal finances of what's been happening in New Hampshire and around the nation. The pandemic has affected just about everybody's economic situation in ways large and small. Lost jobs, of course, have had a huge impact. And even for those whose jobs are secure, their financial outlook may be altered by all the uncertainty, from major decisions like whether to retire or change jobs to small daily choices like whether to go out to eat. We have two guests for our event. Russ Thibault is head of applied economic research in Laconia. Welcome, Russ. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
And also with us, Diana Elliott, a principal research associate at the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute. And it's good to meet you, Diana. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I'd like to put a question out to our virtual audience right now. They are seeing a poll. What we're asking them is, since early March, when the pandemic reached New Hampshire, how has your financial situation changed? Do you feel less financially stable, more financially stable, or about the same? Our second poll question is, of the following options, which things are your biggest financial issues that you're worried about right now? Your current income, your savings and money for emergencies, your rent, mortgage, or other housing costs, everyday essentials like food, or your long-term financial stability like retirement or investments. So while the audience is filling out those poll questions, Russ, let's start with you. How different is this recession from other economic downturns that you've seen in New Hampshire? Russ, you've been watching our economy for a long time.
Yeah, well, I think this is the most peculiar downturn I've ever seen. On the one hand, the economy has taken a hit that it's never seen before. Nationally, a 32% annual drop at rate of annual drop in GDP, unemployment rate that we've never seen before, and similarly in New Hampshire. So basically you can say the economy has crashed, but the federal stimulus has put in a guardrail, really, in the form of $3 trillion, more or less, in stimulus money. So if you look at some of the economic indicators, on the one hand, the numbers look terrible, 14, 15% unemployment rate at its peak, nationally and in New Hampshire, an 11% unemployment rate in New Hampshire, a little bit above that, for the first time I know of, and that's probably covering almost 50 years now, a higher unemployment rate in New Hampshire than the national rate, barely, but nonetheless higher. And yet, if you look at some of the other indicators, it doesn't look so bad. Home sales are rising now from their bottom. They're doing pretty good. We all know the stock market is up 50% from its trough in April. So it's really a very peculiar and unusual downturn.
It is peculiar, Russ. And I've heard you quoted saying health first, economics second. So just give us a little more there.
Yeah, absolutely. Until people are feeling confident that they can go to a restaurant and not get ill, until they can go to a movie theater and not get ill, until they can go to a hotel, until they get on an airplane and not get ill, all those things aren't going to happen. And those sectors have been hit extremely hard, which is why New Hampshire's unemployment rate is higher than the nation. We're a tourist-oriented state to a great degree. We have a lot of jobs in the restaurant industry, in lodging and accommodations, and so we really got hit hard. So until the health thing is under control nationally and people feel that it's under control, probably in the form of a vaccine, we're really not going to get back to normal. You know, another thing to think of, Laura, and I know you're aware of this, it's taken 5 to 7 years normally to fully recover the jobs lost in a downturn. So even without the noise of the virus, when we have a downturn, we've never had one this severe, but when we have a severe downturn, it takes a long time to get back to what we call normal.
Wow. Well, Diana, how do you view it at the national level? How are Americans doing in terms of their personal finances, Diana?
Yeah, I mean, I second what Russ said, which this is, it's really a peculiar downturn, right? But one of the things that I think we saw in 2008 as well is that certain segments of the population are affected more than others, right? So although we have 33 million Americans who've been getting jobless benefits since the start, that's an extraordinarily high number. It's really disproportionately felt by Latinx and Hispanic families and Black families. I think for the first time since 1973, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics started tracking unemployment by ethnicity, Latinx employment is the highest of all racial and ethnic groups. It's around 19% in April. That's extraordinarily high. And there are people, you know, these are families and a lot of people who can't work remotely who are affected severely. You know, they might be in hospitality and leisure, which, you know, as Russ underscored, if you're working in those sectors right now, you're really hard hit. So I think for some families, they're doing fine. They're working from home, and that's a challenge. They might not have childcare. But for other families, this is absolutely devastating. And when you couple the fact that a lot of people get their health care through their employment, it's really a challenging time for people.
Well, I heard just yesterday about a Mexican restaurant in Manchester that had to close because just too many employees had COVID. So there you go. Diana, what were the financial weak spots for these vulnerable families even before the pandemic hit? Was it, you know, not enough savings? Was it poor health care? Was it a high cost of housing? What were the financial weak spots for them even before all
this? I mean, I'd say definitely housing and definitely on savings. You know, what we see is that, you know, over a third of Americans say that they don't have $400 in cash or credit cards to cover an unexpected emergency. So when you have a sudden job loss like this, it's absolutely devastating to a lot of families. I think, you know, layer on that sort of the high cost of housing in so many areas. You know, we find that, you know, I think Harvard study found that nearly half of renters are cost burdened. They're paying more than 30% of their income on rent. And when you sort of layer that on with high cost areas like Boston and New Hampshire and much of the Northeast, frankly, it's really hard when people lose their incomes to continue to pay their rent. And then think about the trickle down, right? That then affects landlords who have trouble paying their bills as well. So it can be terribly devastating to the whole economy.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Diana. Just make the connection for us. So when one family loses a job or has hours cut, it isn't just devastating for that family. There's sort of ripple effects down the line.
Absolutely. So if you think about the situation of a renter, right? You know, a renter, maybe one person in that household loses their income. They have trouble making rent. They have to decide, will I purchase food? Will I pay the rent? So they talk to their landlord and they try to negotiate maybe, you know, paying their rent a little bit later, maybe, you know, paying a little bit less. Maybe the landlord can do that. Maybe the landlord is willing to do that. But in some cases, landlords have to pay a mortgage as well. So they don't want to be late as well. So it's sort of this trickle effect. And then, you know, think about childcare. In our society, a lot of people need childcare in order to work, even at home, right? It's really challenging to work when you have toddlers and whatnot. But if the childcare center is closed, you're not putting your child in childcare. And we're starting to hear stories about small family childcare centers that just can't sustain because it's not a very high profit industry. So you have now small childcare centers that are on the brink or they've closed, again, putting further risk about our future recovery in question.
Russ, make those links for us with a New Hampshire perspective, please. So again, if a family is in crisis or there's a tourism economy, for example, where you live in the Lakes region, if the tourism economy in the Lakes region goes down, if that boat rental place or that B&B on the lake can't make rent or can't pay the property taxes or is struggling, how does that go down the line?
You know, for a while, we didn't know how intense this was going to be. We now know the downturn is intense, although it's ameliorated, mitigated by the federal contributions. But if you look at New Hampshire and let's say Maine's tourism industry, And just this week, I drove from Acadia National Park to Portsmouth on Route 1, which is heavily populated with mom and pop businesses. Many of them are closed. And those businesses don't have the wherewithal to sustain a long downturn. It's looking now, some of the surveys I've seen are that 40% of the businesses that closed because of the epidemic, the small businesses, are not going to open again. There's just as the households, as Diana said, don't have a lot of cushion, financial cushion, a lot of small businesses in New Hampshire, particularly in the tourism industry, also don't have that financial cushion. So even if you asked earlier, you know, how long will this last or what will make it different? The fact of the matter is we're dealing with a structural change in the United States economy already as a result of this, particularly for small businesses, small retailers, and even large retailers like Neiman Marcus, J. Crew, Brooks Brothers, filed bankruptcy, JCPenney. So there's a structural change. When you shut down, we've never shut down the economy. We shut it down in March, April. And as we opened it, we found that, well, maybe that was a mistake in the Southern and some of the Midwestern states because it just gave the virus a new entree into our households. So I think that what we're dealing with here is a very severe impact in New Hampshire, places like New Hampshire, because of the impact on small businesses. And as Diana said, it's lower wage sectors of the economy. And we have tons of that here in New Hampshire. We lost 100,000 jobs in New Hampshire between February and April. We've never had that kind of a downturn anywhere near it. A lot of those jobs simply are not going to come back.
We did ask our virtual audience to fill out a poll for us, and they jumped on it very quickly. First, we asked, how has your financial situation changed since March? And here's what people said. 26% said they feel less financially stable. 9% said they feel more financially stable. And 66% said about the same. Diana, what do you think about that? Does that surprise you?
That rings about true with what I would expect. Again, we have sort of a group who actually has been doing okay. Again, working at home, they haven't lost their jobs. For many people, their savings have actually gone up during this period, which is an interesting sort of contrast to all of the losses that we've seen among lower income and populations where they've lost their jobs. In my experience, there's always sort of a big chunk in the middle that sort of says, I'm doing fine, even if they're not feeling okay. Or some people are just more optimistic. Other people are a bit more pessimistic about their viewpoint. But that quarter that's not doing financially well, I think that really rings true with the national data.
Well, it's interesting, too. You said some people are saving, and of course, you know, some people are joking that, I'm not getting my hair cut. I was going to go on vacation. I'm not going to the movies. I'm not going out to eat. So for some folks, Diana, it sounds like they're saving money. Their personal finances are a little bit better.
Absolutely. I mean, the American savings rate is never great or never standouts, not internationally. But the savings rate has gone up during this period. And I think it's some of the things that you said, right? There's a lot of discretionary income that's not being spent. And also there's a certain psychology about it as well. People get nervous. They get nervous about what's going on in the economy, and they want a better safety net for themselves. And for those people who have that discretionary income right now, you know, we're starting to see signs that some of that is happening.
Go ahead, Russ.
Diana, you're absolutely on correct. But also, a lot of people are actually making more money now on unemployment than they were making when they were working. About 60% of the unemployed, and that's a result of the $600 payment, federal supplemental payment for unemployment insurance. Now, as we speak, that has ended. Presumably, something's going to come to fill the void. But for another reason why a lot of people feel pretty good may be that the supplemental income that has trickled down from Washington for the first time in memory has made their financial situation on a weekly basis actually a little bit better.
You mentioned that people are worried, even if they haven't lost their jobs, even if their income feels stable. You know, people have concerns. And that was our second poll question. What are the biggest financial issues you're worried about right now? So here are the results. 23% said they're worried about their current income. 23% said savings and money for emergencies. 9% said rent, mortgage, or other housing costs. And 9% said everyday essentials like food. Wow, I'm struck by that. And Russ, I'd love your thoughts too. People have a lot of economic concerns.
Well, I think it goes back to there's a lot of uncertainty about where this economy is headed. You may be okay now. You may be part of the 75% that's not feeling terrible, but you watch the news at night. You see a lot of very negative things. You worry, you see the virus surging in other parts of the country. And I think it raises concern in a lot of people's minds about the future, about going forward. Will I have enough to pay the rent? Will I have enough? The 9% for food is very disconcerting. The very basic element of survival. So uncertainty creates a great deal of confusion and a lack of confidence. Uncertainty is the enemy of confidence. So I think that's what your survey is revealing.
It's really interesting. And I do want to remind our listeners that it's our special summer series, The Exchange, live from home. And we'd like to hear from our virtual audience. Tell us what you're spending less on these days, maybe what you're spending more on. And in a few minutes, we will share your stories. You know, Diane, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what Russ said. We're talking this hour not just about people's current financial situations, but their outlook. And how important is people's personal financial outlook, Diana, to the broader economy? Even if they're fine, as Russ said, they may not go out and buy something.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful right now. I think there's still a lot of people for whom 2008 and the recovery is really fresh in their minds as well. You know, 2008 was a different beast entirely, but it's still fresh enough for a lot of people. And a lot of people lost a lot of wealth during that period, lost jobs. That there is a certain amount of nervousness, I think, circulating right now. But if you look at the stock market as a separate indicator, you know, as Russ said earlier, the stock market is back to sort of levels of optimism that I think surprise many, many people right now. So this is a peculiar economic beast right now. It's a little bit hard to read the tea leaves on where we're going in terms of optimism and pessimism. I think there's a lot of optimism that a vaccine will make everything return to normal. Whether that's true or not is something to be said, but there will be long-term impacts to this regardless. One of the things that Russ said earlier about sort of, you know, small businesses closing, I think is really powerful, because then the ripple effect is that that's lost revenue then for cities and counties and small governments, right? Which then impacts many other aspects of life. So There's more to be unpacked here over time.
In terms of that financial outlook, Diana, and the uncertainty that you and Russ describe, you study something called economic stability, economic mobility. What is the impact of this uncertainty on economic mobility? And why is that important?
It's a great question. So economic mobility is the idea that you will get ahead of where your parents were, or your kids will get ahead of where you were, or at least sort of keep your place on the economic ladder. Americans have a lot of anxiety about this. You know, I think you see that sort of materialize in a lot of the anxiety about, will my child go to college? What college will they get into? And one of the things that we saw in 2008, for example, related to paying for college and these long-term mobility enhancing investments, is that in 08, during, you know, just prior to that recession, parents were leveraging their home equity to pay for kids to go to college. As soon as the recession hit, you saw, you know, a very good study shows that curtailed, that parents were no longer tapping into home equity to pay for their kids' college. Kids were then graduating with a lot of debt and were graduating into a labor market that was not conducive to making high wages if they could find jobs at all. So I do worry a little bit about what this will do for our young generation. What will this do for their future economic outlook? Will they be able to attend college? Will they be able to finish college? Will they then come out to a labor market where they can find a sustainable wage? I think there's a lot of questions about how economically mobile will be setting up this next generation of young adults.
All right, we will be right back.
Not only are we proud to support NHPR, but the return on our investment seems to be paying off as well.
Corey Snow was co-owner of Monadnock Oil and Vinegar in Peterborough and an underwriter of NHPR.
We chose NHPR partly because I'm a huge listener myself, and the feedback we've been getting since we started supporting NHPR has been fantastic. We were getting more people coming into the store and saying, hey, we heard you while we were listening to the radio the other day.
Learn more about growing your business with NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
Welcome back to The Exchange, live from home. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the second in our summer virtual events series examining the impact of COVID-19 on New Hampshire and where our state goes from here. We're focusing on how the pandemic has affected Americans' personal finances and their financial outlook. Our guests are Russ Thibault, head of applied economic research in Laconia, and Diana Elliott, economist and principal research associate at the Urban Institute. What are you spending less on these days? What are you spending more on? Are there any economic positives that you see? And Diana and Russ, Mimi says, I'm a CFP, which I'm assuming is Certified Financial Planner, and have been meeting multiple times a day with people who are considering taking an early retirement package. Many people are taking the package, even though it is likely to adversely affect their overall retirement. That is so interesting. And Russ, what do you think about that? People taking early retirement, saying it's too complicated, I'm out.
I think it reflects the uncertainty. I mean, consumer confidence actually has dipped sharply in this downturn. So if you're not confident about your job going forward, but yet your retirement package looks pretty good and secure, you maybe opt for security, over, even though it involves less compensation on a year-to-year basis. So I think that, for example, hospital workers, some are being asked to go on furlough or be laid off, or some are being asked to take early retirement or run the risk of being laid off. So the early retirement makes a lot more sense, I think, for those people. I think it ties back into confidence and not sure where this is going in the future. And perhaps the adage, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Diana, what do you think? I've got a friend who is a teacher, was thinking about retiring in a couple years. And after doing all the virtual learning at the end of the year last year, he said, forget it. I just don't want to do it. And he took early retirement. So I'm wondering if we're going to be hearing a lot of these stories, Diana.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, I'll say one of the most reliable stats on retirement is that people often retire earlier than they think they will and that they plan for. So it's almost like we should start planning to retire early, even if we think we're going to work till 70. But I think it's interesting that he's a teacher, because I think there's a lot of uncertainty among teachers right now about the safety of the workplace. I read recently that about a quarter of our teachers nationwide are over the age of 65. And when you think about how that intersects with the COVID sort of risk group, I think there's a lot of, you know, uncertainty about health and is it safe to work. In terms of the virtual environment, I think that's a whole other set of criteria, right? It's a complicated environment to teach in, but it's interesting.
What about, Diana, people making the flip decision, staying later in the workforce than they wanted to because they're worried about their finances or they can't afford now because maybe their partner or spouse has lost a job? I'm wondering if you're seeing that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a factor as well, right? On the flip side, you have people who realize that they can't retire because they don't have enough money to pay the bills. And I think we saw a bit of that in the 08 recession. And, you know, you're starting to hear some anecdotal stories about that now, but it will be interesting to see what happens long term.
On the chat, we've got a couple comments from people, you know, relating to what you said earlier, Russ, about people just not wanting to venture out. And that's going to be what it takes to get some of these businesses back. Janet says it's too scary to travel, too scary to spend because of all the unknowns. Another person says movie theaters closed, small gift stores going to internet sales, places disappearing locally. Will they come back? You touched on that earlier, Russ, but go ahead. I think there is a sense of people feeling like, well, once there's a vaccine and everything's safe again, everything will come back. But you said earlier, not necessarily. So go ahead, Russ.
Well, Certainly not until we have a reliable vaccine that people have confidence in, will things like the airlines, which are running an 80, 90% decline in travel volume, restaurants running 60, 70, 80% decline in activity. That's not going to come back really back to where it was until that vaccine is in place. Its efficacy is proven. So we've got a long wait here, I think. We're certainly nowhere near close to being at that back to normal yet. I thought personally that this would be like many viruses and flus, that once the summer came, it would subside with seasonal and maybe bounce back in the fall, and maybe we'd be better equipped to deal with it. But it's just blowing right through the summer months.
Yeah.
So it's very disconcerting.
Well, again, to our live virtual audience, join us on the chat. Tell us how you're reacting economically, your own personal financial situation, and what sorts of financial decisions you're making. What are you spending more on? What are you holding back on? What are the biggest economic positives out of this, perhaps, for you? And the biggest economic negatives. We'd love to share your stories. So go into the chat and talk to us about that. A couple more comments. Bridget says food costs have gone up at the store. We are also spending more on takeout to support local businesses, and I am still working. Bridget, I'm glad you're still working. What about support for local businesses, Russ? I have heard some local businesses say, you know, they feel a commitment from their communities. They feel people here in New Hampshire kind of showing them the love. So what are you hearing?
Well, yeah, I think that that's definitely a factor for some households, but unfortunately, they're the minority house. They're the minority of households, not minority households, but they're not, it's not the common. So you do see grocery store sales up, restaurant sales tanking. So people are eating at home more. Restaurants are doing a great job with takeout, conventional restaurants. We've done it. It's very convenient, very well done. But still, all in all, I think that what you're seeing is that there's been a transfer of spending, just as a transfer of spending from brick and mortar facility retailers to online retailers. Amazon's gone crazy. There's been a transfer of food spending from conventional sit-down restaurants to grocery stores.
Here's another comment on the chat. Sophia says, I do not go to restaurants. I do not get manicures and pedicures. I try not to drive much to save on gas, and vacation is out for now. Thank you, Sophia, for writing in. What do you think about that, Diana? People cutting back on those little personal services, and, you know, it's not that painful for Sophia, but for the person who used to do her manicure, it is painful.
That's right. That's right. Sort of what, you know, what we were talking about earlier, is the mom and pop businesses who may really take a hit. And as Russ said, they might not come back. But I think a lot of people are cutting back on some of those discretionary pieces, whether they want to or not. I think we're in a situation where, in a sense, we're forced to because of the health and safety risks. So again, it's you know, some of those families will then have a bit more money set aside.
It gets back to what you said earlier, Diana. Some people are really struggling. Some people find they are saving a little bit more because they're just not spending on vacations, manicures, pedicures, and so forth.
Yep, exactly.
Here's another comment from the chat. Rachel says the optimism is from wealthy people or from people who have not lost their jobs. That may be why the stock market is reacting the way it is. In 2008, 2009, the market spoke volumes. Russ, let's talk more about that. I was surprised to hear you say that the stock market is going gangbusters. My first thought was, why? So go ahead.
No, my first thought was, why not me? You know, I think that what we have here is really bifurcated downturn. There are a number of households that can work at home, workers that can work at home. I mean, it's very disconcerting and whatnot. You may miss the socialization of the office, but you can get by. And so for middle, upper middle, white collar, office type workers, it hasn't been that big a hit. Witness the housing market. We haven't talked about housing. Housing in New Hampshire, we have an all-time low inventory. home prices are higher than they were last year at this time, a lot higher than they were when the epidemic began. Housing construction is bouncing back nationally. In a normal downturn, we lose 20, 25% of housing value. That's not happening this time around. And I think the reason why, Diana's spoken to it very well, that a lot of the pain is concentrated in lower wage jobs that don't have a big, aren't big players in the for sale housing market. Now, if you flip over the renter market, here in New Hampshire, we have now about a 2% unemployment rate. We have a moratorium on evictions. There's a lot of concern going forward about whether those low and moderate income households, especially if they lose the supplemental unemployment, $600 a week, whether they're gonna be able to continue to pay rent and stay in their housing. So that's a big concern going forward. So I think the housing market reflects the bifurcation of this downturn. It's bipolar. Some are doing okay. Some are very depressed.
Well, keep the chat going. We want to hear your comments, your financial situation, what you might be spending more on, what you might be spending less on, and if there are any economic positives out of all this for you. We really want to hear from you. So go into the chat and let us know. Diana, I'd like to hear from you, too, the connection between the stock market and this economic picture that we're talking about, this personal financial picture that we're talking about, because sometimes it does seem disconnected.
Absolutely. I mean, Russ, you know, with discussion of bifurcation, I think that's what we've been seeing for a long time in our economy. And I feel like this point in time has only exaggerated that bifurcation. You know, you have some people that have, you know, substantial retirement accounts and other people who are worried about how they're going to pay for retirement or don't have any money at all in retirement, don't have emergency savings. So you have this very bifurcated economic condition. You know, I'm really struck by some research I did a few years ago, you know, maybe 2014, 2015, where I talked to different groups and they were set differently by income. And the upper income group, they were worried about their stock portfolios. That was their big financial worry. In the middle income and the lower income groups that I talked to, they were doing amazing sort of mental acrobatics trying to figure out how to stage their bills to pay their bills because there's just not enough money every month to pay the bills. So it really reflects this very different economic experience that we have in this country.
Wow. Well, more from the chat. Bridget says, my son manages Wings It in Dover, and they have had tremendous business throughout this whole thing. They went to takeout only right away, and a lot of places just closed. Russ, some restaurants in this pandemic have done very well. Takeout, delivery, they've been pretty busy. What have you seen?
Yeah, I think that some are. Some are doing a great job with the whole takeout phenomenon online and particularly through online marketing. And they have a particular niche that people respond to and are anxious to get back and kind of get out of the kitchen for a change. It's a little brings a little variety into a lifestyle that we're in now that has almost no variety, no new people, no new places, at least some new food once in a while.
Some wings from Dover. So,
yeah, even in Dover, everywhere. So, you know, no traveling, no getting on an airplane. Maybe in our case, no visiting our grandchildren in Massachusetts. So any kind of variety you can kind of garner is helpful. And I think the restaurants, some are doing a great job. Others not so great. I think it's more a dinner hour thing than a lunch and breakfast thing. Obviously, takeout breakfast is not going to happen. So it kind of depends on the menu. And, you know, a solid middle income appealing dinner menu is going to do okay. A luncheon, strong luncheon, breakfast, not so well.
Yeah. Well, we ourselves early in the pandemic said, okay, we're tired of cooking. So every Friday night we try to order from a local Concord place just to support the local restaurant community and also to give us a break from all the cooking. Not that we mind cooking, but it's a lot. So it's really good to get that comment. A couple of questions for both of you about policy choices. And Diana, you touched on this earlier, but I'd like a little bit more. What policy choices do you see, Diana, at the national level affecting the day-to-day financial decisions that Americans are making.
Yeah, I think Russ talked about this earlier, but the extra $600 that families were getting on top of sort of their unemployment claims was really important, right? So, you know, as he said, this was often higher than what some people were receiving at their workplaces. And the early evidence shows that this has kept a lot of people out of poverty. That when you model this out, I have a colleague who's modeled this out for families through the end of December, it could actually improve poverty rates, especially among Black and Hispanic families in this country. Because, you know, minimum wage jobs in a lot of parts of the country don't pay a lot. So that has been a very important policy lever. I'm a little concerned that there hasn't been any traction. This expired on July 31st. There hasn't been any traction on getting something else in its place. And that has been something that has been very important for families, for maintaining stability. You know, I'm particularly concerned that we're facing an eviction tsunami. You know, it's great that in New Hampshire you have a moratorium right now. In other parts of the country, that's not the case. And without that supplemental money, you're going to have a lot of people who will be displaced and with nowhere to go.
Yeah, we did a whole program on the evictions crisis. Yeah, go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry because you can't see me. I don't mean to talk over either one of you. But I did the math, and it's about $180 million a year into the New Hampshire economy, the $600 premium. There are a lot of employers that are complaining that we can't hire people because they can make more money on unemployment. And the fact of the matter is that if you take that $600 a week out of the state's economy, if you take the $180 million a month out of the state's economy, a lot of those employers that are complaining are not going to be in business anymore because there's people aren't going to have enough money to support them. So there's sort of a two-edged sword there, even in terms of the employers that are a little bit frustrated by, you know, if you're getting $600 a week from the federal government, maybe $300 from the state government, you're getting close to $1,000 a week, the equivalent of $50,000 a year. That's pretty good. And that's what underlies a lot of the fact that the savings rate has gone up, credit card debt is going down, housing market's doing pretty good, the rental markets, we haven't seen a wave of the evictions that Diana's rightfully concerned about, pending evictions. So that's a really big deal, and I agree with her. I think it would be devastating to the state's economy if there's not a substantial replacement of that $600 a week. We shut down the economy. These people need help.
Well, listeners are still weighing in. Lori says $600 a week equates to $15 an hour, a living wage. This crisis illustrates that, Lori says. At this point, we need to take a very short break, and we will be right back. It's the second in our special virtual event series examining the impact of COVID-19 on New Hampshire and where our state goes from here. We're focusing on personal finances, how the pandemic has affected Americans' financial health, and just as important, their financial outlook, the decisions we're making about money now and in the future. Our guests are Russ Tebow, head of applied economic research in Laconia, and Diana Elliott, principal research associate at the Urban Institute. And both of you, let's go back to our chat, what you're spending more on, what you might be spending less on, whether you see any economic positives out of the situation that we're in, and we'd love to share your stories. Mary Lou says, New Hampshire relies on property taxes. What will happen when these payments cannot be made? And Russ, I'm going to throw that to you because you are the New Hampshire economist.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I've been looking for an opening to talk about that issue because it's very significant. Office space is emptying out because everybody's working at home. Then if you look at retailing, our malls in Nashua, Manchester, Lebanon, Portsmouth, Newington, they're empty. So our non-residential tax base is getting whacked right now. And that's eventually going to filter into the local tax rate. Now, residential property values are holding up, but to offset the declining values that we're seeing and likely to see in the non-residential part of our tax base, in this state that is extremely dependent on the property tax, we're going to have to raise property taxes on residential properties, even if they hold value. more so if the eventually this thing turns into another, as all of our recessions have turned into around a 20% downturn in real estate values. This one is, that's part of the anomaly here. But I think it has a significant impact on property tax. Here's another weird impact that I hadn't thought of. A friend of mine called me, he's consulting to the town of Plymouth. Plymouth State University is all but shut down. They're one of the biggest users, and this is not, they're one of the biggest users of the sewer system. When there's no water flowing into the sewer system, there's no revenue flowing in to pay off the debt. So there's really insidious impacts on municipal finance that are emerging that are very troublesome in our state that's so heavily dependent on local services paid for with local property taxes.
Well, it's a great question because it does trickle down to all sorts of, as you said, local services, Russ, schools and so on. Can you explain to me, Russ, I feel like I heard that home values were actually up while, as you said, commercial property values are going down because people are working from home and not going to, you know, businesses and restaurants. Is that true here in New Hampshire, Russ? And if so, why would
Absolutely.
That be the case?
Absolutely. One of the reasons why housing is doing, first of all, the office space in the non-residential is declining because people are working at home
right.
or not going shopping.
Sure.
So they're kind of disconnected rationales. Then the housing side is doing pretty well because we have record low unemployment rates and we have a lot of people that are able to work at home, earn the same income. And the difference between a 2.5% mortgage rate and a 4.5% mortgage rate is substantial in the monthly payments. So housing is more affordable now because of the low interest rates than it was before. Now, some people are shut out of the market to be sure, but many people are able to play in this market and do pretty well in it.
Wait, I'm confused. So
different reason.
You said the housing market is doing well, Russ, because we have record low unemployment rates?
No, I'm sorry. If I said unemployment, I'm sorry. Record low interest rates.
Mortgage rates. Yes. Yes. Yeah. They have been almost.
Record low mortgage rates.
They have been almost on the floor.
Versus 3.5%. And the very high unemployment rate is really concentrated among lower wage workers who aren't necessarily players in the for sale housing market to begin with. So
well,
the lower interest rates are helping out housing, higher vacancy rates, people working at home are hurting non-residential properties.
Someone else on the chat relates to this saying rooms and meals taxes are taking another big hit, but residential taxes are already crazy. Time to rethink how we fund this state. I'd like to hear from you too, Diana, on the sort of, we keep using the word bifurcated, but there is a bifurcated real estate market, commercial kind of tanking and residential seeming to do okay. What are you seeing nationally?
So I know a little bit less about that nationally, I have to confess, but I can pick up a thread that Russ was talking about earlier and how this has implications for our governments and how we fund our governments. I had done some research just this past year on the cost of financial insecurity to various cities, and it is extremely costly. When you have families who are unable to pay their property taxes, who are evicted, and then homeless services have to be paid for, who can't pay their utility bills. In some cities, like in Chicago, we estimate this was, like between $68 and $157 million a year. So you can only imagine that it would be on that sort of magnitude for the whole state of New Hampshire as well. That is a huge loss of revenue. It's absolutely in the state's best interest to have financially healthy and financially secure residents who can pay those taxes. And I think it's really interesting that there's a loss in potential revenue because of universities not using the water services. I think that's just yet another ancillary sort of effect that we might see in this economy.
That's really getting down to the micro level. And that's a really interesting story that shows you just how much the ripple effects are there. Nick on the chat says, we are retirees on a fixed income, saving much more now because we don't eat out, we don't get haircuts, keep food portions low so we don't have to shop more than every 2 or 3 weeks. We don't use doggy daycare. We don't pay for luxuries like massage. So this gets back to something both of you have said earlier. Some people are managing to sock more money away because they're just not really going out or going to the theater, or going to the movies or spending money on those little necessities. And again, Russ, while that's great for some people like Nick to save money, put a little money in their pockets because they're not spending on it, there's local repercussions to those decisions. The people who provide the doggy daycare, for example.
Exactly. It's, you know, to say I'm on a fixed income, I say, thank God, thank yourself. You know, thank God you are in this kind of a economic situation. People have changed their spending patterns, not just the elderly, but across the board. The personal savings rate, as Diane said, has actually climbed during this downturn, and credit card debt has fallen. People are using some of this windfall, you might call it, or they're shifting their spending from discretionary items. They're just not buying the discretionary items, not getting on an airplane, not going to a hotel, vacationing close to home, if at all, and not going to restaurants. So there's a shift in consumer spending that is across a broad front, creating some winners. I think very few winners, in fact, mostly online retailers. You talked, Laura, about some of the restaurants doing okay, but a lot more losers than winners.
On the personal finance level, Diane, I'll throw this to you first. What should individuals be thinking about right now to try to keep themselves in financially decent shape for the near future? Obviously, we've all learned there's so much we can't control, but as much as we can control it, what should we be thinking about now? What should our outlook or our perspective be?
Well, you know, I think that people are saving more. It is a good thing. Americans are not generally great savers. So the fact that the savings rate has gone up a little bit, I think, is really important. And the more that people can sort of count on an unexpected expense. You know, a few years ago, I worked on a survey where we found that 60% of Americans had had a financial shock in the year prior. And that included death, it included divorce, it included job loss. So the fact that unexpected expenses are really expected should suggest that more people put money aside and get that ship right in the meantime. I think to Russ's point about credit card debt going down, that's a really positive thing for people's finances too, because potentially their credit scores will go up, which will improve their ability to borrow once they're comfortable and want to borrow in the future. So I think that's a positive as well.
So it seems like you're saying, Diana, Americans' financial approach toward life or philosophy toward life might be a little more cautious or conservative once we come out of this.
This feels more sustainable, truthfully. You know, I've often looked at the data and have been concerned that not enough people can cover unexpected expenses. But again, I think this goes back to that bifurcation that we were talking about earlier, where there's a group of Americans who cannot save because all of their money goes out the door to pay bills every month. And it's that group that I personally worry about the most, especially in this situation, because they're the ones who are taking the biggest job losses. They're the ones who aren't necessarily going to be saved, and their wealth and security could be hampered for years after.
Yeah, those lower wage jobs that were lost in hospitality. Go ahead, Russ. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Laura.
It's okay. Go ahead.
It's a bad habit of mine. I'm sure Diana knows this as well. It's really hard on young people, young households that are just out of college, maybe trying to get their first job. Relatively few people are hiring because of the uncertainty. They're the ones that work in restaurants for the most part. They're the ones that work in the lodging industry. So while we have the minority population that's hit harder, also the young demographic is hit much harder in this weirdo downturn that we're in.
Well, we've got two comments in the chat from people on the older end of the spectrum. Sean says retirees and those on disability are also significantly affected. No extra $600 a week for them above their monthly benefit. Sean says my 78-year-old mom is on a very tight budget with more than 50% of Social Security income going to rent. Wow. 50%. Another person wrote in the chat, when one has only average or less than average Social Security checks, that does not help with lower spending. You have to use savings to augment Social Security inadequate monthly checks. What can you tell us about this, Diana? How people on those meager fixed incomes have been doing during this pandemic?
Yeah, I think that startling, you know, sort of fact of spending 50% or more on rent, I think that that's terribly startling. But unfortunately, there, you know, it's a significant chunk of renters in high cost areas spend that much on their housing. So in the Northeast, you know, that's a little bit more typical than I think we would prefer. There's a lot of people, you know, about, I think it's about a third of renters are sort of in that high, severely cost, low income renters are in that severely cost burdened bracket. In fact, I think I looked it up for Boston in prep for this conversation, and about nearly 8 in 10 low income renters in Boston are paying 50% or more of their income on rent. So if you think about that as sort of a proxy for many places in the Northeast, you know, it's very costly to you know, cover rent on a fixed income and a low fixed income at that.
I want to ask. Yeah, go ahead,
Russ. Problem here in New Hampshire, Diana, as well. You know, overpayment more than 30%, extreme overpayment more than 50% of your income on rent. It leaves nothing for essentially for healthcare, auto insurance. You're already starting with almost no money, and then you've got to fork over that sizable chunk of it for mandatory rent payments. It's really severe, and we're not really doing a lot to address that. And so a lot of the jobs that have been added in New Hampshire have been lower wage jobs. So it's exacerbated the problem. And now when you have those low moderate income people losing their jobs, and maybe losing that supplemental benefit, at least for this week, it's worrisome.
Russ, I want to start with you on this, but hear from you too, Diana. What is the economic uncertainty that we talked about earlier, this personal financial pulling back by a lot of people because they're just not certain? And as many have said, there's nowhere to go if you wanted to go out to see a show or on vacation. What does that uncertainty, Russ, do to wage growth, which before the pandemic was starting to tick up?
Right. Well, when you have an 11% unemployment rate, the first thought is getting a job. And we do have an 11% unemployment rate in New Hampshire, down from 14. The first thought is getting a job. What it tended to do in the last downturn, and I'm sure Diana tracked some of these numbers, is it really stretched out the time before wages started to grow the way you would expect them to as the economy improved. I think we were, as you pointed out, Laura, we were just crawling out of this low wage growth environment. We're just starting to show some decent figures. And now this happens. You know, just as you thought it was safe to go back in the water, you know, the shark fin shows up. So I think that it's going to be very hard for us to see rapidly increasing wages over and above the rate of inflation. That's maybe one positive thing, is inflation is extremely low, maybe even going negative, which is worrisome. So inflation's not high, but wage growth, I think it's a secondary concern to having a job almost at this point.
Wow, that's really interesting. That's a whole subject for a whole nother show, Russ, but because
it's a big ouch.
Wow, because consumer spending is so low, inflation is going almost to negative?
It's almost negative, right, yeah.
Okay.
It's, because there's no purchasing pressure on almost any aspect of the economy.
Interesting. Well, wages, to you too, Diana. You know, for a long time, as I'm sure you know, coming out of the recession, wages were stagnant for a long, long time, but they were starting to creep back up. What does this do to that that wage growth?
Yeah, I've thought about that a little. I think it hampers the wage growth potentially, which is really disappointing because, as you said, it took a really long time. There was really a lag between these very low unemployment rates and increases in wages, which you might have expected sooner. I'll say the one difference between this downturn and the previous downturn is that people were much more locked to geography previously, and they theorized that that was one of the things preventing wage growth in the last downturn. Because people were underwater on their homes, they didn't feel like they could lose their homes in the last downturn. It'll be really interesting to see what happens in this, the aftermath of this recession, because it's not as tied to the housing market. So you might have people who are more willing to move for a job elsewhere.
Oh, that's interesting. And that gets into your research again about economic mobility, why that's important to go out and find that maybe better job in another place. You've piqued my imagination, Diana. Tell me a little bit more about that. I would have assumed, yeah, incorrectly, I guess, that people weren't feeling very mobile right now because of the pandemic.
So, you know, if the housing supply is low and there's lots of eager buyers, you know, I think you're starting to see people thinking about this as an opportune moment. Again, there are people who have the means and the abilities to relocate. But in the past, you know, in 2008, so many people were underwater on their mortgages, they just couldn't relocate.
Oh, that's interesting.
But, you know, studies have shown, at least in terms of economic mobility, the most economically mobile people in terms of getting ahead of their peers in terms of income are the ones who leave, you know, potentially their state to relocate to another state for job opportunities.
Well,
so there is something to that.
And now, of course, we hear from people that they're just, everybody's working online. So we talked to someone who runs a music school who had recently hired a teacher from, you know, halfway across the country, hired a music teacher from Spain because they're just doing everything online. So that's another issue for you to look into, Diana, huh? People working online and being hired by companies all over the world.
Absolutely. And I can tell you anecdotally among my friends and colleagues here in Washington, D.C., you know, this is a very high cost city. So if people can think about relocating to a lower cost area of the country, it's very appealing. And doing their job virtually, that's incredibly appealing.
Russ, for those who have lost their jobs, how much does that affect their earning potential, their wages, when they are eventually re-employed?
Yeah, it depends on the skill level primarily. About 80% of the jobs we lost were in the food service and accommodation industries and retail here in New Hampshire. So I think those positions are already at the bottom of the food chain wage-wise, and they're going to stay there for the most part. So I don't think that it's going to have a dramatic impact on the ability of people to realize in and of itself higher wages, especially when, if in fact, now I think I mentioned earlier that 40% of the businesses that closed are closed, period, small businesses. They didn't close temporarily because of the virus. As of now, they've been surveyed. They said, no, I'm not going back, I'm done. So a lot of those small business jobs are gone. The business is gone. So it's going to be a very competitive labor market. It is now. And when this comes back, it's not going to be a high bounce. It's going to be a dribble.
All right. That was Russ Tebow, head of applied economic research in Laconia, and Diana Elliott, principal research associate at the Urban Institute. Our team here at The Exchange, live from home, is led by producer Christina Phillips, along with engineer Dan Colgan, executive producer Michael Brindley, and Dan Tuohy running the cameras. Patricia McLaughlin is our director of marketing and communications, and the engineering team is RJ Perkins and Randy Woods. Tim Brady is in charge of corporate support, and the wonderful graphics and designs are by Sarah Plord. This is The Exchange, live from home. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.